perhaps in the future we'll retire the number HB77 and just skip from 76 to 78.
Lawmakers consider what to do with the controversial bill HB 77. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, dip nets will be a fixture on the Kuskokwim this summer in an effort to preserve king salmon.
We'll conserve king salmon and allow some very important catch during a time of year when it's good to put fish away.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
With less than a month to go in the session, the Parnell administration is in a similar spot with HB 77 as it was last year. The opposition is vocal. Key senators are on the fence, and movement on the controversial permitting bill has stalled. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
You know a bill is in a tricky spot when even the lead advocate for compromise jokes about the legislation being cursed. Senator Peter Michicki, a Republican from Soldotna, likened HB 77 to a 13th floor on Wednesday.
Perhaps in the future we'll retire the number HB 77 and just skip from 76 to 78. I think in some ways the number is somewhat damned.
Governor Sean Parnell's bill to, in his words, streamline the permitting process initially raced through the legislature last spring. But tribal groups, fishing organizations, and environmental outfits came out hard against the bill, arguing it gave too much power to the Natural Resources Commissioner and limited public involvement in the permitting process. So the legislation was effectively put in time out. It got locked up in a procedural committee while public hearings were held and a compromise was brokered. Administration officials and Michicki, whose vote is needed for the bill to pass, hoped to forge a new draft without some of the more contentious elements. And they figured public sentiment might cool down in the meantime. That didn't happen.
I didn't expect cheers. I didn't expect people to be thrilled with the outcome of the bill. I mean, the bill is the bill. But what I did expect is a fair shake.
Since the new version of the bill was released 2 weeks ago, the legislature has been inundated with phone calls, letters, emails, and petitions on HB 77. When all the testimony is printed out, you get a stack of papers 6 inches high, 2 inches in favor and 4 against. With the bill being such a charged issue, and with just a few weeks left of session, the bill has stopped moving. Public testimony was extended, and hearings for amendments keep getting delayed. Some opponents think it's past the point of compromise. Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat who serves on the Resources Committee, recently announced he would not be offering any amendments to the bill. He thinks it's too flawed to fix.
I would like a great big stake driven into the heart of this bill.
And some of the groups on the fence see the bill facing an uphill battle. Jerry McCune is the president of United Fishermen of Alaska, a seafood industry group that has concerns over the bill. He says UFA is committed to working with the legislature and the administration on the bill, but they're not there yet.
In the short amount of time we have left to digest any other particular changes and get it all figured out, I would say our membership probably wouldn't supported it this time.
McCune says part of the problem is that the bill is so complex, people have not had time to figure out if any of the tweaks to the bill are meaningful.
People are just so mixed up and confused now and trying to keep up with all this that they could probably write it on one page and some people are not going to support it at this point.
Even the administration officials pushing for the permitting overhaul see the massive scope as an obstacle at this point. Ed Fogles is a deputy commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources, and he was involved in drafting the bill.
One of the issues that's going on here is this bill is very big and it attempts to fix a lot of small problems within DNR statutes. So when you look at the bill in its entirety, it gets confusing. You can't really understand it without sitting down with a bill, with a statute book, and reading through it.
For his part, Michicki says some of the controversy may have been avoided if a different approach were taken with the bill in the first place.
Pull it back, change the number, break it up, deal with one issue at a time. It's not where we are today, but I think people have become so focused on... they've become so focused on the number, and they've been so stirred up by people that I don't believe are looking at the issue rationally, that it's difficult for them to see the bill for what it is.
Michicki wants to see a few more changes to the bill before he'll vote for it, but he thinks a lot of progress has been made, and he's surprised by some of the public outrage over the new version. Michicki says he's been reaching out to some of the opponents who have sent him letters. He remembers one woman from Talkeetna.
She sent me one of those, "nothing has changed, I you know, still hate you" emails. So we talked through the bill and found a lot of common ground. And by the time we were through and she saw the changes and we talked about it, explained how code works and things that had been there since statehood and things that had were essentially codifying practices that had been done in the past, we had pretty good conversation.
Michicki wishes he could have conversations like that with every opponent in the state, but there's no way he can personally call thousands of people. And with just a month left of session, that impossible task is even more out of reach. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The government of Canada's Yukon Territory is asking Congress to pay for reconstruction of the Alaska Highway. Premier Darryl Pawlowski was in Washington, D.C. recently to make the case. The United States and Canada agreed in 1977 to work together to improve the northern section of the highway, as well as the spur from Haines Junction to the border near Haines. The U.S. agreed to pay for construction, and Canada would pay maintenance and operations. Premier Pawlowski says the funding should continue.
This has been a great deal for the U.S. taxpayers because the U.S. Congress has put approximately 25% of the money into this highway. However, about 85% of the traffic is U.S. traffic.
The U.S. paid more than $400 million before Congress stopped funding in 2012. Part of the Haines Road still needs resurfacing, but the bigger challenge is a long section further north where the road is on unstable permafrost. Matt Shukaro, a spokesman for Alaska Congressman Don Young, says the road is a vital link between Southeast and the interior, but the U.S. Highway Trust Fund is stretched thin. So Shukaro says it's not an easy sell in Washington.
Members here in Congress have very little appetite to send money to places like Canada when in fact we lack funds to take care of our highway issues here inside the United States.
Shukaro says Young believes the U.S. should live up to its obligation to pay for the highway, but it will take sustained pressure from Canada, the state of Alaska, and the Alaska Congressional Delegation. Republican U.S. Senate hopeful Mead Treadwell has parted ways with his campaign manager. Spokesman Fred Brown says, quote, "it frees up a lot of room for Treadwell to focus on other areas and frees up the campaign's finances." In addition to parting ways with Adam Jones, Treadwell also said one of his spokesmen, Rick Gorka, is also leaving. Brown says Treadwell has a strong campaign structure, but he says Treadwell wants Alaska donors, and going that route, there's a limit to what you can raise. Treadwell said longtime friend Peter Christensen would take over day-to-day leadership of the campaign until a new manager is named. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Ketchikan high schooler takes up an unusual instrument.
My jaw literally dropped because you wouldn't expect the sound to come out of a little tube thing like this.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
Kuskokwim River fishermen will be able to use dip nets this summer to target other species of salmon during periods of king salmon closures. The Board of Fish approved the emergency petition this morning. With the dip nets, any king salmon caught must be released back to the river alive. Area management biologist Travis Ellison told the board that there will be severe subsistence restrictions.
To the point where subsistence harvest opportunities for chum and sockeye salmon could be reduced and impacted in a negative way. Having the ability to allow the use of dip nets to harvest chum and sockeye salmon while live releasing king salmon, we would have the ability to allow additional opportunity to harvest more of those chum and sockeye salmon without impacting the king salmon.
The board utilized a state definition that allows for 5-foot circular dip nets. Board member Orville Huntington from Hooslea spoke in support of dip nets.
It's obviously very, very hard times out there. Regulations are confusing enough, and I think it's needed. It will conserve king salmon and allow some very important catch during a time of year when it's good to put fish away.
The board moved to allow the Fish and Game Commissioner to make the dip net gear a permanent regulation. Otherwise, the regulation will be in effect for 120 days. The Alaska Railroad is celebrating its 100th birthday. Anchorage historian and author Charles Woolforth is writing the history of why and how the federal government got into the railroad business in Alaska. The idea was to wrestle control of resources away from the Alaska Syndicate, a private railroad and coal monopoly run by the wealthy Guggenheim and Morgan families. Woolforth told APRN's Lori Townsend it was a political dust-up that started in the Theodore Roosevelt administration and continued on through Taft and Woodrow Wilson.
One of the first things Wilson did was say, you know, Taft had also said it, but he said, we're going to build a railroad in Alaska to break the Alaska Syndicate and the monopoly that the Guggenheims and Morgans have and get resources out. So it's totally a political thing. It's totally getting beyond this huge scandal and showing that you're going to solve the problem. And so the Alaska Railroad Act passed amazingly quickly. You know, by March 12th, 1914, it was signed and appropriated an enormous amount of money and sent teams, Wilson sent teams up to essentially choose the route.
And how did they decide on the route that they did choose?
Well, that's another interesting part of this political story, because what would have made sense from an economic standpoint, there already was a railroad. It was a Copper River and Northwest Railroad, which ran from Cordova up the Copper River to Chitna and then to Kennecott. You could have built a railroad from Chitna to Fairbanks. It would have saved you a large distance. You already had the hardest part, which was getting over the coastal mountains, and you already had cargo that actually needed to go over that route. Instead, the team that came up to do the surveying spent all of its time looking at a route that went from Seward to Anchorage. Of course, Anchorage didn't exist, and up the Susitna Valley through Broad Pass to Fairbanks, an area where there's nothing, no people there, and there's nowhere near enough cargo in Fairbanks to justify building a railroad. So why did they do that? Well, because Wilson could not go and buy the railroad from the Morgan Guggenheim Alaska Syndicate. That would just be political poison. So he had to go out and build a competing railroad, a different railroad. And there was this fiction that they were choosing among the two routes, but everybody knew that this was going to be the route. And that's really why Anchorage is here, is because of that political calculation. And in the Railroad Act that passed, you know, 100 years ago, it says there will be a town site withdrawn at Ship Creek, and it'll be 3 miles by 3 miles. And there was a Forest Service guy here. It was in the Chugach National Forest at the time, who went out and staked it. So that was happening right about now, 100 years ago.
How much did it cost? And give us the cost of it sort of in the context of, we're talking about a century ago, 1914. What would that have meant nationally?
Well, one of the things I've found fascinating as I've worked on this project is just what a big deal this was. This was something you could put it, say, akin to the Apollo moon program. The federal budget, when the railroad was approved, was $750 million. The original appropriation for the railroad was $35 million. It grew to $72 million. So almost 10% of the entire federal budget on this one project, completely unprecedented. The government had never gone out and built a railroad before. The fact that President Wilson was conscious and aware of decisions that were happening virtually on a day-to-day basis reflects just what a big deal it was. And when you're down in the National Archives doing research on this, you can find the president's signature all over the place, because all kinds of decisions we would think of as small decisions, he approved. You know, he signed the regulations about how land would be auctioned on the Anchorage town site. Just one thing after another, the president is involved in signing it, and or the Secretary of Interior. And so it was a huge national issue. Then, you know, World War One starts. Then it starts taking a lot longer to build the railroad and costing a lot more than expected. And then it becomes obvious that actually there's not enough cargo to justify a railroad by a long shot, and there's not going to be. And so it sort of starts to fade out of people's consciousness, and they don't even finish the railroad for 8 years.
Charles Woolforth is an Anchorage-based historian and author working on a book about the history of the building of Alaska's railroad. He's also a contributing host on KSKA. The Valdez Museum is commemorating next week's 50th anniversary of the 1964 earthquake with the launch of two exhibits. KCHU's Tony Gorman has the story.
When the Good Friday earthquake occurred, it did more than just damage the city of Valdez. The town literally dropped off the map. It took 3 years for locals to relocate to the Valdez we know today. Those events have been recaptured through a new permanent exhibit at the Valdez Museum that is set to launch on the 50th anniversary of the quake. Andrew Goldstein is the museum's curator of collections and exhibitions.
There's a number of items that had not been displayed previously, including civil defense passes that would allow people living in Valdez access to their homes during the period of time when the town was essentially condemned. There's also a Volkswagen door that was donated by the Volkswagen company to assist in rebuilding the town.
He says the museum began collecting items for the exhibit back in 2012.
Our process was to assemble an advisory group of people who had lived through the earthquake and were still in Valdez, so they've seen both pre-earthquake and post-earthquake Valdez, and that was important to us to be able to really get the content and feel of the exhibit right.
Goldstein says the exhibit is built around a domestic setting. He says the purpose of this is to give it a personal feel.
So we chose to use the framework of a domestic setting, in this case a kitchen, to illustrate the urgency and the impact of the earthquake on home life. So the exhibit is arranged as a vignette of what it would be like to be in Valdez's home at the time that the earthquake struck.
The museum is also launching a temporary traveling exhibit on Valdez and the Good Friday earthquake. It's titled Communities, Disaster, and Change, and will be on display in Valdez through September before touring locations in Alaska and Hawaii. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Robert Woolsey. This week on AK, the didgeridoo. You might not expect an ancient Aboriginal instrument from Australia to find its way to Alaska. But walk around downtown Ketchikan on a warm day, and you may hear 15-year-old Kanani Halverson playing her didgeridoo. She's played the unusual instrument for 3 years. And, as she told KRBD's Emily Files, she hopes to bring the didgeridoo into mainstream band practice.
Here's the response Kanani Halverson got from a boy in her seventh grade band when she played the didgeridoo a couple years ago.
What the heck is that? And his like jaw literally dropped, because you wouldn't expect the sound to come out of a little tube thing like this.
The tube thing is actually not so little. Kanani is a tall girl, and the didgeridoo is a tall instrument. It comes up to her shoulders at about 5 feet. You can't exactly play any Katy Perry or Macklemore on something like this. So why is a high schooler here in Ketchikan playing this ancient Aboriginal instrument? It all started with an Australian substitute teacher in Kanani's fourth grade class at Houtling Elementary School.
He brought in his didgeridoo, and I just thought, wow, that is the coolest thing I have ever seen.
Fast forward a few years. It's sixth grade, and Kanani has been playing the trombone for a year. She walks into McPherson's, a local music store, and there, on the shelf, is a didgeridoo.
It's really interesting to hear and see someone play such an intriguing thing like the didgeridoo. And it's a memory that really sticks in your head, so when you see one, and you're like, hey, maybe I could play that. It's a want you really get.
I said, no, no, no.
Chrissy Halverson, Kanani's mom.
Because she likes to pick up things like that, and of course they end up in the closet or elsewhere.
Kanani swore to her mom that she wouldn't throw the instrument in the closet. She brought it home and started practicing. Her older brother, Keelan, was upstairs.
I rushed downstairs because I thought it was a wild animal. Saw her with a long tube and was even more confused.
And then after you found out what it was and what was happening, what did you think?
I was entirely amazed. It was a beautiful-ish sound coming from a stick, and I didn't know how it worked, and so I asked a lot of questions.
Kanani has been playing her didgeridoo for 3 years now. She's had to teach herself because there isn't anyone else she knows in Ketchikan who plays the didgeridoo. Her brother is impressed.
She's definitely improved a lot. It went from a semi-obnoxious noise, to be honest, into something we all enjoy hearing.
The didgeridoo is over 1,000 years old. It's still used to accompany song and dance in the Arnhem Land region of Australia.
But like, what really motivates me to keep playing is that it's such a unique instrument, and really, unless you're in Australia, you really don't get the chance to see or hear or even play something like this.
Kanani is in four bands, three at Ketchikan High School and one other outside school called Sound Waves. She's been on a mission to incorporate this into this.
We haven't had occasion or any particular reason to hear her play it in here, because this is a big band that is mostly saxophones, trumpets, trombones, and rhythm section.
That's Roy McPherson, director of the Soundwaves band, where Kanani plays trombone. The didgeridoo is nowhere to be seen at a recent practice here. But in a couple weeks, that's going to change. Kanani has a didgeridoo solo in the band's upcoming show during I Wanna Be Like You from The Jungle Book. And she's going to keep trying to play her didgeridoo in different settings. She's attending the Sitka Fine Arts Camp this summer.
And so I'll bring it and I'll talk to whoever is running the class, and I'll say, hey, I have a didgeridoo. Is there anything that I should bring it in for?
And if Kanani keeps spreading the sound of the unique instrument, maybe she'll get fewer "what the heck is that?" responses and more people saying, oh, that's a didgeridoo. In Ketchikan, I'm Emily Files.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to the southeastern village of Tenneke Springs, a snowbird community stretched along the beach of Tenneke Inlet.
My name is Don Pegues. I am the mayor of Tenneke Springs, Alaska, located about halfway between Juneau and Sitka in a direct line. We're on Chichagof Island. Arriving either by ferry or private boat or by air, you're right in the center of the community. We're not that big. Our official population is about 152. Year-round, we probably have 65. We have lots of snowbirds here. They're residents of the community, but they like to seek out the sun in the wintertime, like a lot of Alaskans. But the first thing they see when they get in is we're stretched out along a beach of Tenneke Inlet on the salt water. Our downtown area is not very big. We have one old-fashioned store that has been here since the late 1800s. Across the street from it is the Community Hot Springs Bath, where the community got its name. The hot water averaging between 105 and 108. And as a matter of fact, during the past couple of years, has undergone a very, very nice remodeling and renovation by local volunteers. They've maintained the old style and just upgraded with geothermal heating right from the bath and things like that. So it's working out quite good. It's open to the public 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is the centerpiece in town. The economy here is based mainly on fishing and a small bit of tourism. We have a bed and breakfast here, two of them as a matter of fact. We have some very, very talented artists that live here, both in painting and sketching and woodwork and things like that. It's a great place to be, and we invite folks to stop by on their way, whether they're coming up this way or going south, or maybe they're visiting friends in Juneau and can hop on the ferry and come out and visit with us.
Don Pegues is mayor of Tenneke Springs. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community on the segment, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Files, Annie Fite, Dave Waldron, and Jolene Amendavez. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2014 Trails Conference, April 24th through 26th in Anchorage. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.